Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Smartphones have brought something into focus around the country, incidences of what some see as state-sanctioned violence against black and brown people. It's been there all along, but in this digital age, video evidence is seeping out, and the impact has been similar to that of the grainy black and white TV footage of violence against civil rights marchers in the South in the 1960s. Then, as now, being confronted with that evidence has resulted in self-examination and reevaluation. Even before the era of smartphone evidence, these ongoing acts of violence have had a ripple effect, which have really been more like a tsunami on the communities targeted by that violence. Members of those communities, usually poor and uneducated, feel disempowered, disenfranchised, exploited, even disposable. Journalist author Mark Lamont Hill has researched the causes and effects and found distinct patterns to this violence. He writes about them in his New York Times Editor's Choice book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. And Mark Lamont Hill joins us now for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start with the title of your book. Who are the people that you refer to as Nobody?
When I talk about Nobody and this idea of nobody-ness, I'm referring to those people who are marked as disposable, unworthy of investment, as not being deserving of the spoils of democratic citizenship. I'm talking about those people who are erased from the social contract or hidden under the because of the contradictions of capital. The reason why I use that term nobody is because during the killing of Mike Brown, I went to Ferguson maybe a few days afterward, and I saw a really interesting thing. The town was still trying to make sense of his death. People were crying. You could still see the stains in the concrete. There were makeshift memorials, and people kept talking about what it meant for his body to lay out there for 4.5 hours without medical treatment, without a police officer coming. When they finally put a sheet over him, it didn't even fit his whole body. And one of the women who was standing in the community looked at him and said, they left him out there like he ain't belong to nobody. And it stuck with me because that sense of nobodiness wasn't just about the family who loved him, who obviously wanted something different, but it was also about the failure for the medical establishment to intervene, the failure of law enforcement to intervene. He had just graduated from Normandy schools the previous week, that previous June rather, and the school, it considered one of the worst school districts in America, it didn't invest in him. When you look at all the structures of policing, when you look at the fact that 80% of the town has warrants for something or other, so that the town business, the police become tax collectors rather than people who are trying to protect and serve. When you have those kinds of dynamics, then every structure in society rendered Mike Brown a nobody. And I'm saying that around America, we have people who are vulnerable and that sense of nobodiness. It may not play out in direct violence from police bullets, but it can play out in the schools we have or the court systems that we have to navigate.
So you're certainly saying that society and governmental institutions and government policy regard these people as nobodies. Do the people in the community, does that rub off on them? Do they also, you mentioned the woman who referred to him as being treated like a nobody. Do they consider themselves to be nobody? Does it play on their psyche in that way?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's a way, of course, that when you are put in desperate conditions, you can begin to internalize the narratives and the ideas of the structures and of the systems. There are certainly people who, you know, I grew up in North Philadelphia and then West Philadelphia, and, you know, we would drop trash on the ground in our neighborhood, but if we went to a fancy neighborhood, we wouldn't necessarily. We wouldn't go out to Baltimore, PA or Lower Merion, PA and drop trash on the street because we knew trash didn't belong there. So there's a way that you can normalize certain things. You know, if you look at tax policy for school funding, we just accept that people who have big fancy houses and pay a lot in taxes deserve better schools. And we normalize the system that says that the more money you make and the more taxes you pay, the better education you should have. So we accept that poor people get poor schools. So in that way, sure, we internalize and plays on our psyche. You know, white supremacy teaches us that we have the wrong hips and lips and noses and culture and family structures and music. Of course we internalize it, but there's this other way that black freedom struggles have always, always, always pushed back against nobodiness, that we've always asserted our somebodiness. When when Sojourner Truth is saying, "Ain't I a woman?" she's speaking back to a liberal white feminist establishment that is pushing for women's rights, particularly women's suffrage, but doesn't see black womanhood as a legitimate thing. So she's saying, I am a woman. She's asserting her humanity. When people put up signs that said, "I am a man," during labor strikes and labor movements, they were saying, they were marking their humanity, although they obviously excluded women from the narrative. When Jesse Jackson is saying, "I am somebody," in the 70s and 80s, you know, red, yellow, black, or white, we're all precious in God's sight, he's asserting it. And finally, when we say Black Lives Matter, we are asserting that our bodies, our existence, should be central to how we understand American democracy, not at the expense of others, but that our lives matter too. We're asserting our somebodiness. So I think part of what the struggle is about, and part of what I talk about in Nobody in that last chapter called Somebody, is that whenever the world has tried to consign us to nobodiness, freedom fighters have always spotlighted our somebodiness.
I want to go back, to something that you said a moment ago about schools, and make sure that I understood what you were trying to say here, because this speaks to the psychology of the impact of this on people who are treated this way by society. And you said that I think you said that it made sense that people who pay more taxes had better schools than people who are poor and they don't get the same thing. But if you're talking about public schools, they're supposed to have the same quality of education. The whole point of taxpayer dollars going to public schools is to spread the wealth, isn't it?
Absolutely. But when we look city to city or state to state, we see that.
We see the fact of that. But what you said is that we have come to rationalize it.
Oh, absolutely. We've come to accept that, well, you know, this city, for example, if I were to go to a suburb where the tax base is wider and heavier, the per pupil expenditures may be heavier than in a city where that's not the case. And then people say, yeah, but you have these Title I funding, you have all these other fundings that to equalize that. But so much of that stuff ends up going to infrastructure rather than, say, a computer lab. So again, you end up trying to get kids in the most vulnerable areas the most basic of needs met. And in richer areas, for lack of a better term, we find ourselves able to do so much more. It's not a coincidence that if I were to go to East New York, if I were to go to some of the toughest parts of Brooklyn, New York, to have one language taught is for 4 years is considered an exceptional thing. You know, you're lucky to get one language in the school, Spanish probably. And you're lucky to get it for 2 years. I could then go to Westchester and get a very different experience where kids can take 3 or 4 languages and they're all for 4 years. And these differences have huge impacts on the outcomes long-term of children.
So that's one aspect of this, the differential treatment of people given their socioeconomic status and the color of their skin. The other thing, the second paragraph of your book, you say, to be nobody is to be subject to state violence. And you reference the thousands of Americans who have died at the hands of law enforcement, many of them young, poor, mentally ill, black, or unarmed. When you talk about these people being subject to state violence, are you talking purely about that kind of violence, police violence, that is now coming to light because of these cell phone videos, or are you talking about something more pervasive and less visible as well?
It's the latter. Of course, in the last 5 years, we've seen the rise of police-involved shootings being caught on camera. And because of that, we have a heightened attention. When we watch a Walter Scott running away in Charleston and get shot in the back, when we watch Mike Brown choked out with his hands in the air from a chokehold that was banned by the NYPD a long time ago, decades ago, we're able to say, oh my God, something's wrong here. Something is wrong. That we have the capacity to make sense of. We can have debates about it, but we have the capacity to make sense of it because it's in our face, it's visible, and most of us could say to ourselves, at the very least, I wouldn't want that to happen to my child. The problem, though, is that the violence that we see isn't just that. There is the kind of embedded structural violence that we see with unequal access or distribution of resources. When you have to, when you're in a city like Charlotte, for example, where you have to go sometimes 20 minutes, 30 minutes on a bus to get access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Mark Lamont Hill is our guest. He's the author of Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. New York Times bestseller Mark Lamont Hill is our guest. He's written a book called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. He joins us via Skype today from New York. We were talking before the break about state violence and state violence being perpetrated on these folks who have fallen through the cracks in America, the poor, black, brown people that we don't really see in some cases. And you say that state violence, well, when people think, when our listeners think about state violence, the images that come to mind are probably those cell phone videos where police encounter black people and tragic ends come to the conclusion of that. But state violence is more than that. We've talked a little bit about policies that keep these people down or don't offer them the kinds of opportunities that other people get. Another means of state violence, it seems to me, is development in poorer areas that leads to gentrification. And I'm going to ask you about that because you were speaking at Central Piedmont Community College, I think, the other day for Habitat for Humanity, and at the very beginning of the program, protesters got up before you even had a chance to open your mouth and called on you to denounce Habitat for its practices that they say lead to gentrification. What was your response to that?
You know, it was an interesting moment. I mean, I support free speech and I support democratic utterances, however they break out. I would have preferred we had created space and time for a conversation. And according to the folks at Habitat, there hadn't been an opportunity to have that conversation prior to the protest. So I'm not against protests. I just always think that protest has to be a tactic that's used toward a particular end. And it's usually not plan A for me. But I think that the gentlemen who protested were right to be concerned about gentrification and right to raise critical questions. Their concern wasn't with me. They were pretty unequivocal about that. They said, we don't have any problem with Mark Lamont Hill, but we do want, and later on they said, we want him to cut all ties with Habitat for Humanity. I don't have any formal ties with Habitat. I gave a speech on housing at a symposium that I think was very valuable. I do think that we all have responsibility, not just Habitat, but everyone, to answer those tough questions about the consequences are of our particular policy initiatives and our particular social justice initiatives. I don't have any knowledge of Habitat engaging in gentrification practices. I'm open to be persuaded. I'm open to be taught. I'm open to be heard.
Isn't that a conundrum? Because when you improve an area, if an area has gone into decline and you're looking to help people improve their neighborhood and improve their lives by putting sweat equity into building a house, it's a new piece of construction. It does improve the neighborhood. You put a couple of those houses in, the neighborhood is noticeably better, and people start thinking about that neighborhood differently, and they're thinking, well, maybe I could move in there too. And that leads to this gentrification. You said to the people at that meeting that as long as there's capitalism, there's going to be gentrification. So how do you strike a happy medium? How do you get a balance going where you can improve people's lives and people's neighborhoods without having to ultimately push them out of that neighborhood?
Well, we have to have a commitment to it. We have to actually make that an express goal and a policy target. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. I have to actually say that pricing people out of a neighborhood is not my goal. And then I have to carry that vision out by offering things like rent control, by limiting the type of development that happens in neighborhoods, by not uprooting some of the cultural and institutional kind of landmarks and monuments that tie the indigenous people of the neighborhood to that area. So these are all things that we can think about, right? We have to push back against policies which are largely designed to incentivize gentrification, like the, for example, in Philadelphia in Center City, when they were trying to, well, not just Center City, actually throughout Philadelphia, they developed programs to sort of prioritize certain types of movers in their quest to access certain kinds of high quality public schools. And so essentially what it did was it made people who could probably access private school more likely to get a high quality public school free. And then they're now competing with families who can't, who don't have the economic resources to access private education, if they even believe in it, as many of us don't. So in that context, we're looking at public policy that make the lives of people who live in these neighborhoods, who always lived in these neighborhoods, more challenging, which is what we saw in West Philadelphia, to be specific. So we have to have a policy. We have to have a policy, Will. We have to have a kind of an imagination that's bigger than, and I think more socially justice oriented, than simply saying every person for themselves.
So how did we get here? Because you have referred to this as an increasingly intense war on the vulnerable. That's a pretty powerful statement. How did we get here? Is this just people falling through the cracks because they don't have economic means? Is this the natural progression from slavery to Jim Crow and beyond? And since you're also talking in this book about LGBTQ people and immigrants, is this more than the natural fear of the other, which is found in all societies, especially during times of social upheaval and economic uncertainty? How do we get here?
I don't like the terms natural progression. I will say that it is an inevitable progression of capitalism. And what we've seen at different junctures in human history, or American history more specifically, is kind of pushbacks to those progressions by installing policies and mechanisms that are not purely capitalistic as such, like the social safety net, like public assistance, like other things that sort of undercut the ambitions of the free market. So what you end up with, though, is a state that over the last 30 to 50 years has become increasingly less invested in the social good, increasingly less invested in providing social safety nets. So when you ask how do we get here, it's because we decided to shrink the state in many key ways, you know, in the 80s. We expanded the state when it came to military, we expanded the state when it came to police, we expanded the state when it came to surveillance, and we limited the state when it came to social supports. The medicalized state and the socialized state, meaning that when people have medical problems, we invest in them medically, and when there are social crises, we create social safety nets. We moved away from that. So, for example, if you have someone who is suffering from a mental illness, and you look at where they were in 1974, 75, and you look where they would be 10 years later, the difference is quite stark. And it's because toward the end of the Carter administration, really through Reagan, we began to really move away from funding mental health facilities, and community-based funding as well was stripped away. So what you end up with, people who were once in mental institutions who are now on the street. And then we create all these social laws that make it illegal to be on the street. So we've essentially criminalized mental illness and criminalized homelessness, criminalized poverty. We've criminalized the medical problem of drug addiction. So if you continue to criminalize social and medical problems, then we're not medicalizing as a state. We're not socializing as a state, to use the language of Loic Bacon, but instead we are simply penalizing. We're making everything criminal. And so one of the best ways you can hide your contradictions as a state, as a nation, is to take the biggest problems, the biggest contradictions, the biggest crises, and hide them. Homelessness, we hide it. Drug addiction, we hide it. You know, and we hide it through jail. We hide it through these makeshift shelters. We hide it through all these other means. And we then create a kind of public sentiment, and this goes to the last piece of the question, that makes the vulnerable undesirable. So we don't just have intensify our war on drugs in the 80s. We create junk science. We create fake narratives, super predators and crack babies and crack monsters that make people think that somehow the person who's doing crack isn't just making a bad choice, but they're actually a bad person, which makes it much easier to put bad people where? Jail. Now, if I tell you that my lawyer or my accountant does cocaine on his desk, you're like, oh yeah, he's making a bad choice. You know, those college kids up at this Ivy League school, they're doing coke in the dorm. Oh, they're making a bad, nobody wants them in jail because they're not bad people. They're just making a bad choice. But when, but with crack and other unhealthy practices attributed to the poor, we make them not just make them bad people. And so those kinds of logics, it's not just about fear of the other, because I think fear of the other to some extent is a human experience. The question though is who gets constituted as the other? I've been here and my family's been here for hundreds of years. Why am I still other, right? And, you know, I am poor. Why am I marked as other? And so it's not the fact that there isn't other, it's the specifics of who's getting othered. And that practice, I think, is not natural. That's an extension of a very particular set of political commitments and ideological orientations.
So the book has a one-word title, Nobody. The chapters have one-word titles, Broken, Bargained, Armed, Caged, Emergency, and Somebody. Obviously, deliberate. What was the significance of that choice?
You know, I wrote the fifth chapter first. It was called Caged. Because it felt right. And then from there, I got to be honest with you. You know, the first chapter, the second chapter that I wrote was the first chapter. And then honestly, from there, I was like, this is kind of cool. I mean, and I said, let me see if I can think of a singular word for each thing that really encapsulates how I feel and how the chapter articulates a certain claim. And it worked, and so I just went with it.
Yeah. So the first chapter, which you wrote second, is called Broken, and when you say that these nobodies have been broken, are you referring to the inordinate attention that many of these people get for the smallest or merely suspected infractions of minor laws that, if more affluent people had been caught, would either have gotten off with a slap on the wrist or wouldn't even have an encounter with the police in the first place? Is that what you're talking about here?
A bit. I mean, you know, I'm alluding specifically and directly to broken windows theory and broken windows policing, which becomes the model, which hinges on a particular assumption, which is that there is a relationship between crime and disorder. And so the idea of broken windows policing was that if we could just get rid of all the disorder, we could get rid of a whole bunch of crime.
And so, New York City tried that for a while. It didn't work, did it?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you ask. You know, if you were to ask people who live in Times Square, near Times Square, they'd say, oh, clearly it worked. Look how neat Times Square is. You can walk through there. It's like Disney now. It wasn't like that in 85. There are people who would say that, yeah, New York looks better, feels better, shootings are down. There is some truth to that. But the problem is with broken windows policing is that it doesn't necessarily, it overstates the relationship between crime and disorder. And what often happens is disorder gets marked. The things that get considered to be disorder often are more markers of race and class. So what you're actually doing is not policing crime, you're policing black and poverty and blackness. And what you end up with is an over representation of police in our community and a very funky relationship between communities and policing, and which really isn't even what the creators of the study and the theory intended. When they talked about broken windows policing, the idea was still that I could make choices, that there would be a community beat cop who'd be walking around, and yeah, he might see you drinking, you know, liquor on your steps, and what he would tell you is, you know, put it in a bag, and you know, yeah, you might cut school, and I'm not arresting you for that, I'm just taking you to your parents, you know. And so there's the idea of knowing what actually counted as a crime and being able to kind of police the neighborhood and reduce disorder without criminalizing everything. The problem is our response has been to criminalize everything, and you're right, we're not looking for crime everywhere, we don't find it everywhere. If I were to raid Harvard tonight, or Yale, or Princeton, or Columbia, or Dartmouth, or Brown, or if I were to just walk through the campus at Friday at 2 a.m., I mean, how many people could I arrest for public drunkenness and disorderly conduct? Mm-hmm. But we don't look there. And so part of the challenge is that you're right, we, you know, the number of encounters you have with the police are going to certainly shape the number of arrests you're going to see and the number of the amount of criminality that gets attributed to you.
So while that broken windows approach was being followed, at least in New York City, evidently a preponderance of citations for these nuisance crimes were handed out, mostly to blacks and Latinos. Is that because they were the ones committing most of these nuisance infractions, or because they had special attention from law enforcement?
Yeah, they were the ones getting policed. Police are going to arrest you if they police you. Again, if I walk through Harvard all night, I could find some folk too. But I'm not. And so, you know, black and brown folk got these citations because the city was looking for them. The police were looking for them. And unfortunately, those types of encounters, when you already have a fear of black bodies, can lead to police-involved shootings much more quickly. If you perceive the person to be violent and disrespectful and guilty when you encounter them, and there are studies that show that this is the case, then you're much more likely to have an antagonistic interaction with the person. You're much more likely to want to see a different outcome.
We're talking to Mark Lamont Hill this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Lamont Hill was recently in town to talk at a Habitat for Humanity conference. He's written a book called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, which is what we're talking about today. We were just talking about the justice system, which really doesn't work very well for a lot of people on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. They don't have lawyers. They have to use public defenders. They resort to plea bargains because it's more efficient, and that reduces actually the amount of justice. And I want to flip that on the other side of that for a second, because we've had recent examples of white-collar crime where people are not walking, but they are, in many people's opinions, being under-sentenced. Paul Manafort, the judge in the federal crime that took place in Virginia, the recommended sentence was enormous, and he gave him 47 months and said that Paul Manafort had led an otherwise blameless life. It shocked a lot of people. It shocked prosecutors. It shocked Republicans. It shocked Democrats. As unfair as it might seem to many, could this incident actually turn out to be a useful way to spotlight inequities in the system?
It can be. I just worry that it then leads to us wanting Manafort to get more time, as opposed to reimagining the logic of criminalization such that we want other people to get less time. In other words, when police officers get like relatively low bails when they're accused of shooting someone, we get upset. And I agree that there's an injustice, there's an inequity there when you see the kid that breaks a police car getting $1 million bail and you see the cop getting $100,000 bail. But too often our response is to say, give that cop $1 million bail. And I'm saying, well, no, let's not do that. Instead, let's realize that bail is not a punishment, that bail is not intended to incarcerate you, and bail is not intended as a way of taking away or stripping away your economic vitality. It's intended purely to make sure that you return to court. And studies have shown that it doesn't necessarily do that. So I'm saying let's get rid of the cash bail system. So when you have these high-profile white men who get slaps on the wrist, I think they can be an opportunity to change the conversation. But we have to do it with the right political imagination, which is not to live in a world where we hyper-carcerate everybody, but instead where we can extend the same sense of justice to everybody. There was a woman a few days ago who was sentenced to, I believe, 36 months probation after hitting and killing children in her car. And people were sort of talking about the gap between that and, you know, the black woman who ended up doing jail time for lying on her address, about her address so that her kids could go to a better school. We look at this new high-profile scandal around college admissions, where 40 celebrities are accused of cheating, and people say, oh, they're not going to do any real time, but Jussie Smollett is facing, you know, 16 felony counts.
Well, let's talk a little about this over-incarceration, because we have more people in prison in America than we have anywhere else in the world, pretty much. And a lot of those people in prison are black or brown. And you say whether prisons are publicly or privately administered, mass incarceration itself is largely indebted to an overarching prison industrial complex. You call these the overlapping interests of government and industry that use policing, imprisonment, and other tools as solutions to economic, social, and political problems. We all know this, I think. How did it start? Why did it start?
Well, I mean, since slavery, we've had an exploited class. We've had a vulnerable class of people. I mean, the American project, the American democratic infrastructure is built on the backs of unpaid African people who were enslaved here. After slavery, after emancipation, we saw quickly the rise of black codes. And the black codes were a set of laws that derive out of the slave codes that allowed, that hyper-criminalized black people. You could be criminalized for cursing. You'd be criminalized for being out of town. You could be criminalized for being unemployed. And because the 13th Amendment banned slavery except under conditions of incarceration, they essentially were saying, you can't be enslaved unless you commit a crime. And then we made everything a crime. Through the black codes. And so then you saw the convict lease system where people would get criminalized, they would go to jail, and then they could get leased out to the very same plantations and farms where they were slaves before. So we saw slavery by other means. Now, 100 years later, 150 years later, we continue to see slavery by other means through these prisons where you see people working for pennies an hour, where the contradictions of a labor market that just simply can't fit everyone are resolved. In other words, everybody can't get a job, but if there's 2.5 million people in prison, the market's a lot more friendly. We're not going to invest in mental illness, but if we make it illegal to be on the street and people are buying crack as a form of self-medication, we can lock them up for crack. And so many of our economic challenges as a nation are resolved through the prison, not to mention the broader industrial complex that you mentioned. Or that you quoted from me, talking about all the industries that come along with the prison, the contractors who work in there, the cooks or the catering companies that send food there, the actual townspeople who work as COs and secretaries and janitors in the prison, the parole and probation officers, the lawyers, there are entire businesses that are beholden to the existence of cages. And that's the world that we have to change if we have a serious commitment. But as long as there is an infrastructure that needs prison, then we're going to have prison.
So that's capitalism, the fact that we have publicly operated prisons as opposed to, or privately operated prisons as opposed to the government's running them in many cases. Are these unintended consequences? Or were people aware of their motivations when all of this began?
You know, I can't say what's in people's heads, hundreds of years ago. What I can say with certainty, though, with complete certainty, is that there is no doubt in the minds of people in power that there is money to be made off of prison. And they continue to make money off of prison. Hmm. So I can't speak to the original intent.
So do you see attitudes about incarceration, about tough sentencing, about privately owned prisons, about privatizing the public defender's office? Do you see those changing at all?
I think so. I think when people read Nobody, the whole world changes. No, I'm kidding. I think that the center can't hold forever. One thing you've seen is more bipartisan support for, at the very least, criminal justice reform. And the reason is because it's becoming too expensive to lock up the whole country. So again, it's not out of feeling, it's out of interest. But whatever it takes, I think we're beginning to see the change. Also, white kids are addicted to opioids at higher rates than 20 years ago. And suddenly those same senators that wanted to get tough on crack want to have a humane approach to, you know, crystal meth or heroin now and all these other things. So I think, again, maybe not for the reasons we'd like, but the world is changing a bit.
So this book, Nobody, isn't just about criminal justice and injustice. It's about social justice as well, and the people being impacted by what you see as this country's obsession with, quote, free market logic, which you say has devalued the public good and inspired policies that wreak havoc on the vulnerable. And you point to the galloping conscienceless capitalism, which led the city of Flint, Michigan, to essentially betray its citizens. Flint, of course, had the water problem with lead in the water. Is Flint an outlier or just a city that got caught?
A city that got caught, for sure. I mean, there are some extraordinary things about Flint in terms of how bad the water got. When you look at the parts per billion of water, of lead in the water, and you look at the number of warnings people got, in fact, the automaker in the area said, hey, we have to stop using your water because of the fact that the water's rusting out the parts. But children are drinking this. That's somewhat extreme compared to other cities like, say, Baltimore or Cleveland, Philadelphia, where there's clearly lead in the water. So I don't think that it's unusual. I do think it's an extreme example. The fact that there was an emergency manager as opposed to a traditional governor running the finances at the time, because the state was not in the black. These types of factors, it was like a perfect storm, but it's a perfect storm that is animated by a set of market conditions and a set of institutional arrangements which aren't unfamiliar all around the country, all around the world at this point. So, if Flint is an example of what happens if we continue to move in the direction that we're moving in.
Your book isn't just about the police shootings of African Americans, but where it is, a lot of people would say, if only these victims had just done what the police asked them to do, get out of the car, put your hands up, get down on the ground, etc. Now, you admit that in many cases, not all of these victims were innocent. You point to Michael Brown in Ferguson, who had stolen cigarettes from a convenience store prior to his being killed by police. He made other bad choices, too. But you say those choices did not warrant his death. You've researched that case. You watched the videotapes. You went to Ferguson. How could that have ended? What other options were there, given the circumstances?
It's a good question. You know, and this is, you know, one thing I would tell people is, you know, me saying that Mike Brown wasn't innocent is not a way of understating the enormous injustice that took place. You don't have to be innocent to go home at night. You know, stealing cigarillos out of a store is a crime, but it's not a capital crime. You don't get the death penalty for that, and that's essentially what he got. Same thing with Alton Sterling. Why am I saying that? Well, because we have to imagine a world where you don't have to be perfect, you don't have to be going to college that Monday, you don't have to be on the honor roll to not die at the hands of police. I want guilty people to get a due process. I don't want them to get killed on the street by a police officer who acts like judge, jury, and executioner. Read Darren Wilson's grand jury testimony. I think he was legitimately scared. I just question why. And if there is an irrational fear of black bodies in the way that we saw in the case of Tamir Rice and other, you know, this kid who was shot by police. When we get those kinds of circumstances, we have to figure out, before you get to that scene, what can be done. So it's not just what can Darren Wilson have done differently, it's what can we do structurally. Well, one, we shouldn't be stopping people for jaywalking. Let's remember, Mike Brown wasn't stopped for stealing from the store. Darren Wilson didn't know he stole from the store when he stopped him. He stopped him for jaywalking. So if you live in a city where 80% of the town has a warrant as of 2016, because of these petty things like jaywalking, then you're essentially just raising money by arresting the vulnerable. That, if not for that project, there would have been no stop. There would have been no death sequence. We have to train police officers in ways that reduce their biases. If we do that, we're death sequences.
Mark Lamont Hill, his book is called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Thanks so much for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.